This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It has come to my attention that last week's show was a little bit of a downer, leaving some listeners depressed. The management has asked me to read the following statement. Everything is fine. The future will be fine, too. The scientists you may have heard are just eggheads with a horrible agenda to enslave us all. There is plenty of oil for everyone. Plenty of cheap food. Eat your fill. Just relax and go to your job if you have a job, or stay home if you have a home. There is nothing to worry about. I am sorry if the future frightened or offended anyone. Alex Smith.
There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, and tomorrow's just a dream away.
According to a pseudo-scientific study, as reported by the Washington Post and the New York Times, alarmists,
like Alex Smith,
are causing more people to disbelieve in claims of global warming or peak oil. The Post's headline, "Gloom and Doom on Climate Can Backfire," new study says. Actually, as Joe Rome points out at climateprogress.org, the study doesn't say that, and the testing was just on a small sample of college students, but it fits what newspapers would like to say.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking fact?
The study of UC Berkeley does show most people believe the underlying narrative of life on Earth is positive, essentially that God is just. We'll let the good Republican representative from Illinois, John Shimkus, explain this as he did to an Energy Committee hearing last March in Washington, D.C.
So I want to start with Genesis 8, verse 21 and 22. Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. I believe that's the infallible word of God, and that's the way it's going to be for his creation. The second verse comes from Matthew 24, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. The earth will end only when God declares it's time to be over. Man will not destroy this earth. This earth will not be destroyed by a flood. Two other issues, Mr. Chairman. Today we have about 388 parts per million in the atmosphere. I think in the age of the dinosaurs, where we had most flora and fauna, we were probably at 4,000 parts per million. There is a theological debate that this is a carbon-starved planet, not too much carbon.
And so you don't need to worry about all that carbon in the atmosphere, because God and the angels will save us from our sins. Science showing the contrary conflicts with and loses out to this deeply held belief. So the mainstream media and climate doubters tell us we should limit our talk here on Radio EcoShock to the positive side of the story. What a wonderful world it will be, lit up with LED lights. You will enjoy the ocean more now that it's closer. Most people will save on the clothing budget now that summer lasts most of the year. How am I doing?
What, they're only forestalling the inevitable end. Screw their tomorrow. I prefer to deal hands-on with the real future that awaits this stinking planet. The one of eating cancerous rats raw on the radioactive bilge-filled trenches of a shattered tomorrow, while the Krypton lasers slash the stinking skies overhead. Oh yeah, where are you gonna charge up your laptop, Ben? Ha!
That was just one of several clips I pirated this week from Bob's Slacktime Funhouse. Show number 840 is called The World of Tomorrow Will Suck. Find a link to that one-hour program as broadcast on WREK Atlanta in my show blog for this week of November 25th, 2010 at ecoshock.info. But let's just say, as an act of imagination here on radio, that fossil fuels do run out in a wildly heating world. James Howard Kunstler has brought that future into print with his latest book. You'll hear that interview next. And we have Tracy Mayer on the program, the self-styled Armageddon Mama, with the age-old problem, how do we talk to our friends and family about the coming apocalypse? Authors and artists often express the future years too soon for our own comfort. James Howard Kunstler is like that, and worse, he's one of the best American writers of the day. Some people love to read his articles while hoping he's wrong as hell. I'm Alex Smith. I'm honored to have James Howard Kunstler join us to discuss his new novel, The Witch of Hebron, and what it means for our future. Mr. Kunstler, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's great to be here.
In your 1994 book, The Geography of Nowhere, you describe the modern landscape of strip malls, antisocial architecture, badly functioning suburbs. Are we more ready to dream along with you into a simpler world precisely because we feel so little love for our present surroundings?
Well, that's a very good point. And I think it's true that these things that we've built, these environments that we spend our daily lives in, tend to be places that are not worthy of our affection. And, you know, that has a big effect on how we think about the world and our life in it, our place in it, literally our place in it, because, you know, we don't really like the place that we find ourselves in.
No, I was just standing on the corner of a six-lane road ready to be run down by anybody, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here?
Well, you know, a lot of people have that experience of, you know, every day. And you know, I go all over all over North America, and I go to places like, you know, suburban Texas. I just don't know how people can manage it.
In 2005, you made a new mark in the peak oil prediction with your book, The Long Emergency, and that almost began a movement. Are you gratified the International Energy Agency finally just admitted peak oil may have occurred in 2006? And will that push more people into taking your novel seriously?
The IEA was extremely coy about it. And the only thing they really did was publish a chart in which they indicated that there would be massive amounts of new oil found and developed for which there's no evidence. So they backed into something that just about every other authority in the world has already admitted.
And the first book in this series we're going to be talking about is World Made by Hand. What should we take from your second title, The Witch of Hebron? Why did you choose that?
Well, you know, I'm trying to get people into this world that I've created of the post-oil North America. And I'm trying to get them to sort of feel the textures of and sensations of what it's really like to inhabit a post-petroleum and, to some extent, post-economic collapse world. You know, a world in which, though, the electricity is not on anymore and you cannot run to the Internet for everything and you barely know what's going on outside your county, and most of the work that is occurring is, you know, happens in and around agriculture. And you have to work shoulder to shoulder with your neighbors, and you're eating food that's grown locally that, you know, you're not getting mangoes from the Caribbean anymore. And it's a whole different way of life. And, you know, the thing that I find most amazing, perhaps, is the public's inability to imagine living under different circumstances. It's really very striking.
It sounds a little bit like 18th century America or even the Middle Ages. Do you think that the future will contain some resurgence of the past?
I do happen to believe that, although I hasten to point out that composing a novel is a kind of emergent, organic experience. It tends to tell you where it's going on its own. And, you know, there are things I learned about this world that I was creating in World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron that surprised me. For example, within the first 10 pages, I realized these people aren't riding bicycles. They can't get the, you know, the special alloy metals necessary for the replacement parts, and they can't get rubber, and the pavements are all broken up because they, you know, they're living in a much more austere, much less affluent society, and you know, we have no idea how much money it takes to just keep the roads in passable condition on our continent. So, yeah, I think that things are going to be, I think that we will be discovering and rediscovering a lot of practices that we haven't done in a long time. And, you know, everything from having larger households with more people in them to working in some other way than sitting in a cubicle in front of a screen.
I was trying to picture your writing process. You seem like a person very plugged in. You must be buffeted by a stream of discomforting news, as we all are. And yet you are doing creative writing. How much is calculation and how much inspiration? Is that possible to say?
Well, I'm basically not a very neurotic writer. I may be a neurotic person, but I'm not neurotic about writing. I don't get blocked. You know, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't distract myself with all kinds of avoidance behavior. What I've discovered over a career of writing books of various kinds is that, you know, you just sit down and you engage in the task, and then it tells you what to do. And the most important thing is engagement. It, you know, it kind of gets to what one of the great social psychologists of the age said. He's got a very complex name. He's an Eastern European named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and he wrote a very important book called Flow about 10 or 15 years ago, and it's all about the process of mental engagement and creativity, really. And, you know, it's a process that you have to have respect for. And the first thing you have to do in respecting it is show up.
Would you recommend people read The Witch of Hebron to prepare themselves for a crash?
Well, both of these novels I've written, World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron, will eventually comprise a series of four books, which I'm planning to write, you know, one for every season, sort of like Vivaldi's concertos. They stand alone, you know, you don't have to read them in sequence, but, you know, I think that they might help people mentally prepare themselves for a different world. You know, the catch is that unlike Cormac McCarthy's The Road or other visions of the future, this one is not wholly bleak and negative. It, you know, it's not an ecotopia by any stretch. But, you know, what I have tried to do is picture a world in which there are actually quite a few positive developments. They may be things that people have walked into kind of backwards or inadvertently, like the fact that they have to make their own music with their neighbors because you can't get canned entertainment anymore in a world made by hand. You know, they're working with people they know at things that matter to them, and that's just sort of a consequence of what has happened to them. You know, they still find joy in life. They still find love. They live in an ecology which is, to some extent, recovering. Cars are not running anymore in this world I've created, and, you know, nature is coming back rather robustly from the indignities of our time. And, you know, they're hearing the birds sing, and they're breathing clean air, and, you know, they're feeling the full sensory experience of being connected with the planet again instead of leading a mediated existence.
I have lived that life for 10 years without electricity, and I still miss it. Getting back to the book, many expect the court system and the rule of law to break down in a dystopic future. Perhaps it's already broken down. And yet your characters still search for justice. Can they find it?
Well, a big theme in these books, in these novels I've written, is the search for the rule of law and justice. These people are keenly aware that the rule of law has more or less abandoned them, and they're suffering, and they spend an awful lot of their energy in the book trying to reestablish it. So a lot of the plot of both of these books is attempts to get people to pay for the consequences of their action in the absence of any legal apparatus. I do have to say, I think the rule of law even now is fading away, but oddly enough, at the highest levels first. You know, it has fled from the financial scene, where regulation is no longer taking place and where enforcement is no longer taking place. And that's partly responsible for the banking fiasco that is now underway. And Mr. Obama in the USA has not been able to reestablish it. Nobody has been prosecuted for the frauds and swindles of the last several years. And there's not even any sign that there's any federal investigation of it going on. None whatsoever. We're now in the middle of an enormous mortgage document scandal that may fatally injure the real estate business because no one can establish real title to property. And so the rule of law is very much at stake even today before things seem to have broken down.
Not to mention the possibility of a war criminal publishing his own book and going out on a book tour. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with James Howard Kunstler about his new post-carbon novels, World Made by Hand and The Witch of Hebron. I found most of the central characters, Jim, were men, wandering vagabonds like Billy Bones, the boss man organizers like Mr. Bullock or Brother Job.
Well, they're not wandering. Brother Job is hardly a wandering vagabond.
But they were the boss men, we would say.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, this is a world in which hierarchy has been reestablished, you know. I personally believe it's been one of the luxuries of our time that we've been able to pretend that human society is not hierarchical, when in fact it is and mostly has been through human history. I actually got a lot of complaints from female readers that my female characters were not sufficiently heroic or valorized. Well, you know, I replied to them, frankly, that I found it odd that they were unable to imagine a very different economic and social future in which social relations might change between the sexes. You know, everybody seems to be expecting that that our social relations will continue a la 1998 forever. And we don't seem to have any imaginative capacity to think otherwise. So it's a strange thing, but, you know, it just sort of represents a sort of cultural programming that's gone on.
Another question I might raise is not really about your vision, which I have to agree with, but perhaps your timing. The stock market lasted years longer than any of us thought. And
yeah, including me.
Oh, I know. And we still haven't seen a period of military rule. Our time of the Caesars hasn't happened, and maybe city-states. So where I see waves of trouble and regrouping, you're predicting a fundamental breakdown possibly within the next 10 years. Why do you say that?
Because I think that what we're seeing, self-reinforcing feedback loops of broken and impaired and wounded systems that are going to amplify and ramify each other. For example, the banking system is one of the complex systems we depend on. It's now deeply injured. It can barely function. And most of the major activities of commerce and international trade and even local trade don't function well without banking. And, you know, we're discovering that to our dismay right now. When we get into trouble with oil, and, you know, we're about there, especially at over $80 a barrel, that's really when it starts injuring North American economies. You know, that's going to affect the trucking system. It's going to affect the price of things in retail. It's going to affect Joe Sixpack and everybody else who has to go out and pay for gasoline. And, you know, we're going to start seeing that affect the agriculture sector. The banking failure will affect the agriculture sector. Many people don't realize this, but one of the biggest, quote, inputs for industrial agriculture after the oil and gas-based herbicides and fertilizers is capital. They need to borrow a lot of money every year to keep their stuff going. And capital is going to get scarcer and scarcer. So we're seeing these systems that are affecting each other, and I think that they're going to get into trouble much sooner than a lot of other observers. For example, you know, the airline system has been on its knees for the last 5 or 10 years, and especially the last 5 years with the price of oil going up and down and not being reliable. I mean, it's very hard to conduct business when you don't have a reliable business model with prices that are predictable. And, you know, the next time we have a major price hike in a barrel of oil, I think you're going to see the airlines stagger.
Do you think this banking collapse and the finance problems will have an impact on the fossil fuel situation as well?
Absolutely. And actually, a Canadian gal named Nicole Foss has been one of the most astute commentators on it. And, you know, the point that she's made is that what we refer to as demand destruction, you know, when ordinary so-called consumers cannot buy as much stuff as they used to, that demand destruction eventually leads to supply destruction. Because what happens is less and less capital is available to the oil industry, and they simply aren't able to develop the whatever few discoveries they've made and get them into production to offset the ongoing depletions that, you know, are going on every day. What's more, we're faced with this additional problem that has been referred to as the oil export problem. And by that we mean that the nations that send oil to us are increasingly using more and more of their own oil and unable to export as much as they had previously. So the export rates are going down a lot from places like Saudi Arabia and Mexico. And you know, these are like our number two and three sources of imported oil in the USA after Canada. Mexico was our number three source of imports. They've gone to number six in just 18 months because they're in such steep depletion. So all of these things are really going to end up expressing themselves very vividly for us.
I've heard you have a new nonfiction book in the works. What could you tell us about that?
Well, it's sort of about how we're messing ourselves up with our technological grandiosity, the techno-rapture, as some people have called it. You know, we have this idea, we're programmed to think that technology will furnish us with some silver bullet to get through this bottleneck that we face. And I think we're going to be very disappointed to discover that you can't run suburbia and Walt Disney World and Walmart on any combination of alternative fuels or systems. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to use them. I think we'll try every kind of alternative energy there is. It's just important to realize we're going to be disappointed by what they can do for us. We're going to have to run a lot less stuff, a lot more modestly, and we're not at all prepared for this.
I was speaking to a San Francisco city planner last week, and I said, well, I'm going to be talking with James Howard Kunstler. And he said, well, would you ask him if he will be bringing forth suggestions about ways we could transition our existing institutions for a softer landing?
You know, there's a great wish that we could just, that there's some kind of program to follow. You know, there's really a few things that we need to pay attention to very generally, and one of them is that this is going to be all about downscaling and relocalizing. You know, and if you can adjust your thinking around that idea, then, you know, you can come to some better outcomes. For example, people are knocking themselves out trying to think of new ways to run all the cars. Can we run them all on electricity? Can we run them on biodiesel or natural gas or some other thing? But the same people will put absolutely no effort into talking about walkable communities or public transit. This year in the USA, you know, in association with the banking failure and the economic disaster, we spent all this money on stimulus for highway projects. Well, you know, I don't think we're going to be running the car system in 5 or 10 years the way we've been used to it. We need to make investments in the North American railroad system, because this is a big continent, and I don't think people are going to get around in 10 years if we don't have a railroad system in place that's any good. And we don't right now. You know, both Canada and the USA have allowed their railroads to deteriorate horribly. I'm talking about passenger, not freight. We've allowed all these lines to be torn up, and double tracks especially, which allow passenger trains and freight trains to run separately. We have a railroad system that the Bulgarians would be ashamed of now. And that's just not going to cut it. You know, we got to put more investment in that. So, you know, walkable communities, public transit, things like this, this is where the benefit's going to lie for us, not in techno-raptures about buying more electric cars, because that's not going to work. That's going to disappoint us.
Getting back to your latest book, The Witch of Hebron, I went over to your website for the book, thewitchofhebron.com. And I listened to that excellent interview, I thought, with Peter Golden. And you questioned there the viability of the publishing industry as well. And I've noticed a huge decline in author book tours here. Do you think this World Made by Hand series will find a new home in a movie, perhaps, for the screen generation?
You know, it's funny. My agent and I were talking to a major, shall we say, venue for television a year ago. And we went up against another dystopian story. They were shopping for a dystopian story, and they picked the one with zombies in it. So you can see where their heads are at, you know. A lot of industries now are in disarray, and publishing is one of them. You know, They're not selling as many books as they used to. They've been firing people left and right. They don't have much money. It was never a really big money industry. I mean, it was always pretty much a kind of gentleman's small change boutique industry. And it kind of blew up into an overblown thing with conglomerates in the last 20 years. But now it's in a period of contraction like other things in the economy. And we don't know if the old publishing model of the mid-20th century is going to persist, you know. You know, a lot of people are doing different things. A lot of people are publishing themselves, or they're, you know, using independent booksellers to publish. There are new networks being established. A lot of people think that the actual hard copy book will not be with us that long. I don't know about that, because I have even more doubts about the internet staying with us forever. You know, I think that eventually we're going to have problems with the electric system, with the supply of electricity, you know, in various regions of North America, not all at the same time in the same way, but, you know, the places, for example, that don't have a lot of hydro, the places that are burning just natural gas or coal, they may get into trouble sooner rather than later. So I'm not convinced that electronic books are going to be with us forever. But there's no question that the writing industry is in disarray. And another layer of it, of course, is that at the article level, at the magazine level, with all of the hard copy magazines going out of business, it's almost impossible for young writers to find a way to make a buck or even get into the game. The way, you know, when I started out in the 1970s, you could at least pay the light bill by writing stuff for glossy magazines, you know, even if it was only recipes. Now, you know, you can't even make a buck doing that anymore. So it's a pretty gnarly situation out there.
Well, as we wrap up, James Howard Kunstler, here in the fall of 2010, I feel like we're floating in the eye of a storm. It seems like big things are happening behind the scenes.
Me too.
But the mass media is boring and filled with trivia.
Incredible.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, right now, I mean, just as we're talking today, you know, there's some question about whether the European currency system is going to blow up. And this has been going on in the background now for about 8 months, really, but especially hard in the last 2 weeks. And yet you wouldn't know that, you know, anything really momentous is going on out there. You know, all kinds of weird things are going on in the background of the USA, and we've got this new Mortgagegate scandal that's all about inability to document whether or not people actually own the property they say they own or are trying to foreclose on. We're hardly talking about that, and it's a huge problem. So, yes, you're quite right. It's a stupendous thing that, you know, that we're the only thing we seem to pay attention to is Bristol Palin on Dancing with the Stars.
Well, that's why I depend on your Monday morning blog at Kunstler.com. I do read it every week, and one of the phrases you used in it was being stumped out loud, and that's how I feel. I just don't understand what's going on, and I think I'm a well-informed person.
By the way, that's a line from The Witch of Hebron. I've got a character named Brother Job who runs a Christian cult, and he's a Southerner, and he's discovered that his horse is poisoned, and he doesn't know what happened to it. And he tells this lady that's in the cult with him that he's stumped out loud. And she says back to him, "Everything you are is out loud."
Is there anything you'd like to add, a parting message?
Well, you know, I wish the best for people. You know, I certainly am. I'm not a doomer and a gloomer. I like to characterize myself as an actualist, because I'm interested in what's actually going on out there. And, you know, I think people will enjoy my World Made by Hand novels, and the new one, The Witch of Hebron. They're designed to be at least very interesting and funny and dramatic. And I'm going to go on, write some more books, and keep on keeping on.
Our guest has been author and urban critic James Howard Kunstler. Find out more about the book at thewitchofhebron.com, at your booksellers, or just go to Kunstler.com. James, thank you so much for your time and for your insight.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Kids learn today's gaming skills for play and keyboard skills for jobs. They'll all be virtual workers unless the world doesn't turn out that way. Under the shadow of ever-rising oil prices, an unstable climate, and an economy held up by magic balloons, how should we prepare our kids? Tracy Mayer is a parent who writes for a living, her work appearing in such diverse publications as Salon, Computer World, and the Boston Globe. Her latest book, Mommy Prayers, captures the humorous desperation of motherhood. I found Tracy through the New York Times under the headline, Preparing Kids for the Apocalypse. That was kind of a steal from Tracy's original work in Brain Child magazine, which she edits, titled Armageddon Mama, Parenting Toward the Apocalypse. With my own family, I often wonder, what the hell should I tell the kids about all this? Should I try to aim them toward college or learning to make their own shoes? Let's try and sort some of this out person to person. Tracy Mayer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thrilled to be here.
I notice you actually defend the suburbs. Didn't you get the memo that suburbia is toast in America?
Well, actually, I'm in the suburbs and not really in a position to leave. So I think, you know, you try to make do with what you have. But actually, a lot of the reading I did said that, you know, if something were to come down, the suburbs might not be a bad place to be. So hopefully we've made the right decision.
We just got a bit of a breakthrough here in our city where one of our mayors has come out and said, go ahead, plant your front lawn with gardens and your back lawn, and we'll encourage you. You could even do commercial gardening. I've been waiting for that day for 30 years.
Oh, right. And at least where we are, you know, I'm sure it's happening everywhere. The chicken phenomenon is on the rise, where people are getting a couple of chickens in their backyards. And my son is dying to get two little pygmy goats or a sheep, but we have a really crazy dog, so we have to wait for the dog to move on to to a different lifestyle before we can get any pets.
I get you. Well, what got you interested in the basics of survival?
Well, as I say in the beginning of the article in Brainchild magazine, we had a ice storm, it was actually not an ice storm, it was a blowdown. In the winter last February, and we were without power for, I think, 3.5 days, and some places in our town were five days. And just that tiny little experience of having, you know, no heat and lights for 3.5 days was enough to be like, wow. And that's when we realized, sort of by tromping down into our basement, that our stash of stuff that we had put in there after 9/11, when we were told to do so, had just been completely pillaged. You know, my kids had taken we had all these batteries, those went to the game controllers, and we'd, you know, taken our canned goods and given them to the food bank at some point, and we had water, we used that for a, you know, school event. There was very little down there. We couldn't even find our flashlights, so we said, wow, we are really clueless here. If something happened on some kind of semi-permanent level, we would be toast.
I'm hoping there is a quiet revolution going on in people's expectations. What are you hearing from parents about the future and their kids?
Well, you know, I think it's a real mixed bag. Speaking as Brainchild's editor, we're an alternative parenting magazine, and we have a very highly educated and really thoughtful readership, which we love. And I would say that those people, it's not that they're hunkering down in some kind of cellar that they've dug out, but they're very up on climate change issues. I think they're very, very up on thoughtful parenting and trying to, you know, really prepare kids beyond these sort of milestones that we're told to expect, you know, with good college and all that kind of stuff. They're really trying to raise good people. At the same time, when that article was picked up, it was mentioned in the New York Times in their Motherlode blog, which is also a very thoughtful place. Many, many people there and many people I know personally said that something like thinking about some kind of disaster and your children had not crossed their mind once, ever. So I think there's a pretty wide range of reactions.
Your article in Brainchild magazine wasn't the puff piece we so often see. I noticed you did your homework and you tracked down some useful information. For example, I didn't know about Sean Broderick's new book, The Ultimate Suburban Survivalist Guide. What is that about?
I actually loved that book. I actually went out and bought another copy for my dad because it's right up his alley. I did an interview with him, and he said, I think he's, you know, he's kind of up on all of this, you know, disasters. He's a financial columnist. But he pointed out, he lives in Florida. He has two younger kids. They're, I think they're both still in elementary school. He lives in Florida, and he said, look, you know, we're a lot closer to the edge down here. There's, you know, the potential for different kinds of citizen unrest is a lot closer to the surface. Their recession has been very, very bad down there, as I think everyone knows. The potential for all kinds of weather-related disasters is much closer, and, you know, they've had hurricanes come roaring through there. And he said, you know, you really have a closer sense than other places of things sort of falling apart and maybe not coming back together. So his point about the suburbs, I asked him, well, how come you picked the suburbs? He said, that's where a lot of people are right now, and it's kind of, you can't pick up your house and move it once a disaster starts to roll, either something, a weather-related disaster or some kind of longer-term economic societal thing. You are where you are. So that book is just full of great tips, and of course we haven't really done too many of them yet, but I like the idea of them.
Well, you've brought up something that always bugs me. There's this persistent narrative about the coming breakdown. Brave men, followed by their hard-cooking women, take off into Montana to defend the compound with high-powered guns. Is that really what happens when society goes into a period of stress?
Well, actually, I interviewed a professor called Stephanie Kuntz, who's really good, and she's done a lot of research about families in present-day and families in the past. And she said, you know, even our myth, at least in the United States, this sort of myth of the wide open frontier and people just lighting out and leaving society behind is actually, it is a myth. The West was built with a lot of government support and government intervention, and it's not true that it was cowboys running around shooting each other. There was quite a lot of organized law enforcement that was going on there, and people building roads and bridges and you know, building town wells and all that kind of societal stuff. So she was one of many people I talked to who said it's not, first of all, there's no place to go. If you're living, I live in a small town of 8,000 people, but if you've got 8,000 people all out in the same town square trying to forage for mushrooms or acorns or whatever, you're not going to make it, and that's what she said. She said you can't forage your way out of a disaster. You need to work with other people.
And again, you brought up another good book, Rebecca Solnit's book, A Paradise Built in Hell, The Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. How does that help us? What can she tell us?
Yeah, that was another fabulous book. I just got to read a lot of books for this. It was a great article. Her book was really fascinating. Darkness and light at the same time, and she studied, I think, five different disasters starting from the earthquake in San Francisco in the 1900s and moving up through Katrina. And what she found is that the ordinary people, you will be depending on your neighbors, and by that she means your physical, the people who are physically next to you when some kind of event happens. And, you know, not your virtual, your Facebook crowd or the people who follow your Twitter feed or your blogger readers. It's really going to be the people next to you physically. And that people form alliances with other people who have like needs. So if you and the person standing next to you are both trying to get out of a flood zone and you have your pet with you, and the National Guard has said, don't bring your pet, you're not allowed to bring your pet, well, suddenly you are an ally with this person who also has a dog, so the two of you can start problem-solving together. And that's what she said she's found, is that ordinary people actually do extraordinary things and kind of reach across divides when they see a commonality.
Did you find some survival strategies coming from families in the Great Depression of the 1930s?
Well, same thing. That was also Professor Kuntz. She said that people really needed to share, and that it was partly a matter of being altruistic and being, you know, moral and upstanding and all those things that we hope we would be in a disaster. But it was also, if you're afraid that you're not a person who would have those good things come out in them, it's just a matter of practicality. If you share what you have with your neighbor, you're banking that person is going to share with you when they get something. So she said, you know, when they got a sack of flour, they would share it among many, many families. They wouldn't hoard it because you can't do anything with just the flour. You need some leavening agent and you need some sugar and then you need a little bit of meat with that. And, you know, so you need to share not just for the good karma, but also because it's a practical necessity.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with New England author and journalist Tracy Mayer. And let's get back to the focus of getting kids ready for difficult times. As you point out, today's kids are likely overweight and mostly divorced from nature, no outside time. What can parents do to prepare them?
Well, I don't know. You know, I didn't really come up with any hard and fast solutions. I mean, I think obviously it helps for your kid to have a wide range of skills. Sean Broderick, who wrote the Suburban Survivalist book, he said, you know, your kid doesn't have to be able to do all kinds of, you know, they don't need to know how to shoot a deer with a bow and arrow, but they should have one or two things that they know how to do. And the kid should have some time outdoors in nature, sort of away from a mediated environment. I know Richard Love's book, which a lot of people know, Last Child in the Woods, he laments that even kids who do spend time outside, you know, they're spending it on a sort of organized surface. They're on a sidewalk, or they're on a soccer field, something that's been groomed and taken care of. And just the act of getting out beyond something that's controlled, very visibly controlled by humans, is enough for people to start thinking, you know, outside the box a little. I know my own kids at their school, they have a Project Adventure program. You know, it's kind of an outward bound thing. It's small. It's not, they don't go for weeks, but they do have, it's a ropes course, and I mean, it's also team building and trusting your fellow student and all that kind of stuff. And I think a lot of schools have that now, but if your school doesn't, it's a great thing to push for.
Yes, you point out a couple of rays of hope that some schools, including private schools and public schools, are looking towards more practical training, a little bit anyway.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the Montessori and the Waldorf traditions in the elementary and preschool are very hands-on based. And a lot of kindergartens, in my experience, preschool and kindergarten, they still have kids doing stuff with their hands. But what I found that was kind of a bummer is that when you start around middle school, at least in our state, and I think a lot of others, you really start to push this high academia, which is great. You want your kid to be learning all these things, but sometimes it comes at the expense of what we used to call home ec and shop class. So I am trying to get my kids to take the very few offerings that our school still has. There's a class at the high school where they teach you how to repair, like, lawnmowers and small motors, and I think that's fabulous. So I'm wrestling with my older son now to get him to, you know, drop one of his AP classes and take that class.
What is an AP class?
Oh, advanced placement. It's one of those, you know, it's run by the same people who run the SAT classes. It's a high-level academic course, and they're very difficult, but supposedly they make your college transcript look terrific to admissions officers.
Okay, so in some of your research here, another question I have, and I wonder if some of the people talked about this, is how we talk to our kids about our fears for the future. You know, mommy or daddy comes off the computer looking pretty worried, saying, oh boy, we're in big trouble. What do we say?
Well, it's interesting because I saw from your earlier shows that you've talked about that pathological optimism. That's one I'm personally still wrestling with. You don't want to paint a picture that's unnecessarily rosy or just say, oh, hey, let's all go about our consumerist ways and some geek is going to think up some wonderful solution to this. But at the same time, you don't want to depress your kids. They got a lot on their minds already. I mean, you know, the teen years and even early 20s, there's a lot of stuff going on. So I think we're just trying to strike a tone of awareness and also, I think, appreciativeness of what we do have. I really try to have my kids not take what we have for granted and try to live sort of low to the earth. I think I mentioned in my article, you know, we do, you know, the sort of regular things that you would hope a lot of families do. We recycle, we compost, we belong to a community garden organization where we get our vegetables 6 months of the year, that kind of stuff. You hope that your kids just absorb that and think of that as a normal way to live. We keep the heat really low in our house, which drives my older son crazy, but... So, you know, try to do those awareness things and then also try to hope that they will choose something in life that's somehow working toward the solution, being part of the solution, somehow paying back into society, and hopefully they can be one of the people who comes up with some kind of solution to this.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Kathy McMahon. She's sort of the peak oil shrink, and at her talk I was surprised to find so many women in the audience, and they were really educated about our dependence on oil and the fact it might run out someday, and many of their questions were, how do we talk to our relatives and our workplace friends about this without being just sort of shoved into that box of Armageddon Mama?
Right. Right, right. I mean, it is. I have a lot of people, including my close friends, kind of rolling their eyes and saying, oh, my gosh, why are you writing about that? And I don't know, you know, I mean, it's very hard not to have people be skeptical, but I guess it's just sort of small things, day-to-day things, and then trying to move people along. We've, in our town, just in our tiny town, we switched from a volunteer recycling program to an enforced recycling program. And people screamed and yelled as if you were cutting off one of their legs. But I just noticed in my neighborhood when I was walking my dog, all these people who never recycled as much as a milk jug, the second there was a dollar figure attached to it, they were out there with their bin full to the top. So, I mean, people do change, and I think you can sort of pick one thing and then add the other one on and hopefully go from there. I mean, I feel like I need to remain optimistic about this even when some of the information is overwhelming.
Is there something I've missed, Tracy, something you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
I did mention this in my own story at the end, and we haven't talked about him, which is funny. Bill McKibben, who I'm sure a lot of your listeners are already well familiar with, I had the honor of being able to interview him for this story, and he has a new book out called Earth, which is with two A's. It's E-A-A-R-T-H. And that book was fantastic, I felt. It's actually a short book. It's a difficult read. He kind of paints the picture, the reality of where we are now, and it's very heartbreaking. But the second half of his book is a lot of what we've talked about, is sort of prescriptions for soldiering on, living on this tough new planet. I think that's actually the subtitle of the book. And I'm just trying to get as many people as I can to read that book. I think it's really fantastic. And his organization is 350.org. which I follow along with, and I try to get a lot of my friends to as well. They're very positive, activist, upbeat, and trying to get things going.
Very good. There you go. You can get the kids ready for college or the medieval ages or both. Our guest is Tracy Mayer. Her latest book is Mommy Prayers, and don't put that down until you've tried hurting little feet while getting up five times a night. Tracy has serious articles in many places, but she always seems to bring a dry sense of humor into that darkness. Find her really thoughtful article, Armageddon Mama, at brainchildmag.com and follow her own work at tracymayer.com. Tracy, thank you for helping us out.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. There is some savage financial news out there. In my show blog for this week at ecoshock.info, I've linked to just a half dozen stories you might have missed. Consider it your homework assignment. Roadmap that opens up shadow banking by Gillian Tett of the Financial Times. You won't believe what these geniuses were up to, the extent of the fantasy and fraud in the banking system. Which leads up to a piece from the Wall Street Journal, quote, U.S. invest insider trading probe, and especially an excellent expose by Jake Bernstein and Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica. The title is Banks Self-Dealing Supercharged Financial Crisis. It is a long piece with a complete explanation of the fraudulent collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs, trillions of dollars of fantasy money stashed away in bank vaults as assets. The Federal Reserve, on orders by George Bush and then Obama, has purchased up to $40 billion worth of this junk from the banks, and they are still sunk. As the truth comes out, banks worldwide could collapse, in my opinion. It may take years, or it may just take days. Shed a tear for the Irish people who just found that out. A scallywag named Sean brought the Anglo-Irish Bank from just 8 employees in 1995 to a giant empire of debt, which just collapsed. 17% of the bank deposits were withdrawn in the past 2 weeks alone. A foolish or corrupt prime minister guaranteed all the Irish bank debts, with the people to pay for a generation or more. When the cupboards ran dry, the German and British debt holders brought in the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the European Union to enforce the debt. Now the poorest people will pay as the government slashes social programs while keeping taxes high. Look at Ireland and watch, for that is the future of many countries, a ripple of consolidation of the remaining oligarchs, unless they tumble as well. Meanwhile, I've linked to Bloomberg's stories, prime U.S. mortgage foreclosures hit record as unemployment hurts finances, and U.S. homeowners drop out of foreclosure program amid record defaults. with a final flourish of unemployment benefits to end for 2 million Americans. Whew, okay, so let's get a little good news in here, and there are drops of good news. Despite the collapse, some of the world's largest solar plants are now starting operation. Sun Edison claims the largest single solar facility in Rovigo, Italy, at 70 megawatts. Well, the biggest in Europe, anyway. Germany has the largest overall facility with several linked solar farms. In fact, Germany and Spain lead the world in solar power. Canada seems to have set a new record, opening an 80-megawatt solar farm in Sarnia, Ontario. It's up there and it's going and it's beautiful. The U.S. is way down the list, with the largest being a 25-megawatt solar plant in Arcadia, Florida. But Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced approval for what will be the world's largest solar thermal plant in California, the Blythe Solar Power Project in the Mojave Desert. As fossil fuels run down, and as the public experiences extreme climatic danger, we will operate the remaining civilization on whatever clean power we have installed, and that does include nuclear, I'm afraid, but in the long run, the sun, the wind, the tides, and geothermal will provide. We have taken the first baby steps. But the road is long and dangerous, as you know. The U.S. government reported recently that nearly 1 in 5 Americans experienced some form of mental illness in 2009. Modern disconnected life, with its giant fears, has taken a brutal toll on us all. Check out our recent Radio EcoShock programs on the psychology of climate change and peak oil awareness for some tips. Part of the great healing is to reestablish our relationship with growing food. The process is good for us, as is the organic produce. Like a great ice field cracking open, the impregnable icon of the lawn is starting to fall. In just one example, the city of North Vancouver is encouraging residents to tear out their lawns and plant food gardens. City Councillor Craig Keating has raised bed gardens in his front yard. The city even allows commercial farming of home yards. One company called City Farm Boy leases yards and even rooftops to grow vegetables. Homeowners get a share of the fresh goodies, as do 38 shareholders, paying an annual fee for their weekly basket of veggies from May to October. This is earth-shaking. People can stop poisoning their lawns, start composting their waste, and begin tasting real vegetables right at home. It didn't travel thousands of carbonated miles. I'm going to play you a clip from the radio show Unwelcome Guests, Hour 2 of show number 523. It is an interview of critical mass biker and Frisco lifestyle changer Chris Carlson. He is talking about his new book, Nowtopia, how pirate programmers, outlaw bicyclists, and vacant lot gardeners are inventing the future today. We'll tune in as Chris explains the urban gardening scene in the United States.
The gardening movement's an interesting one because it represents something of a reclaiming of the commons. And people went, you know, you go back to World War II, I can back up even further, but I'll just start it there. You know, we had this big victory gardens movement in the United States instigated by the federal government because they wanted people to grow more food to help the war effort. And everybody, you know, for a great number of people, that was how they could contribute, was by growing food. And what, by the end of World War II, 45% of the fresh produce consumed by Americans was growing in urban gardens. So when we think about a kind of a systematic transition toward a more relocalized life in which we produce the things we need locally amongst ourselves, and practical things like food and energy and transportation and communications is really what I'm talking about here, the food model of having, think of cities as urban food forests. They could be. We could actually probably top that 45% number if there was a, you know, kind of like a let's go to the moon type mentality about let's grow food in cities. Now, where would we do that? In just in vacant lots? I mean, that's where the movement starts, is vacant, you know, People's Park in 1969 in Berkeley. One of the first things they do after they take this fence down from the university to put up around a lot is they plant a urban organic garden. And that influences people all across the country. And pretty soon you have people doing this in vacant lots all over the place. And it's not new knowledge. It's actually very often connecting to the elders in the community who had already had a great experience of learning about the local ecology, putting their hands in the soil, figuring out what would grow in the specific areas with the specific microclimates and soil conditions and water availability, et cetera. And that knowledge got transmitted across the generations in these gardens. And now you have, from the 70s onward, this proliferation of community gardens all over the major cities of the United States. Now we live this totally fragmented and atomized life in which everybody's moving all the time, either moving from job to job or home to home. And there's not that sense of stability, and there's not that sense of knowing each other. And if you want to talk about sort of, you know, movements for serious political change in our culture, you really need to have stable communities that know each other and trust each other so they can envision it from below. It can't be something just imposed from on high. And so this breakdown in the working class left a bunch of things behind, which was destroyed communities and urban life in back east. There was these giant riots in the late 60s, and they burned down parts of the cities. And then the landlords burned down other parts of the cities. And the city's administrations in New York and Detroit and Philadelphia and places like that abandoned whole areas out of this sort of spatial deconcentration and you know, racism and other obvious factors. And so the people left behind, oftentimes, you know, women-centered communities slowly but surely start to rebuild their sense of community life. And one of the ways they did that was by invading these empty lots that had been abandoned that were full of needles and broken glass and cement and rubble, and clearing them and realizing this is a great space for a garden, for a space for our kids to play, but we have to clear it out. So they would spend a lot of, you know, community would come together to do that. They would plant beautiful flowers and trees, and then they would start thinking of how they could grow food there, and people would meet there across generations and across ethnicities and across different musical tastes and all sorts of different things. And then you have these amazing thriving spaces. And they really proliferated. You had over 1,000 of them in just in New York City. In San Francisco, we have about 120. You know, there's huge areas of Detroit now that are under the control of what's called the Detroit Agricultural Network. And they're actually farming with tractors because there's so much empty land there. And Philadelphia has another, you know, 900 gardens and so on. And you can just find this story in every city. And in these gardens, then, you have these new communities and you have people actually thinking about food security and really producing things for their own needs. And something really beautiful starts to happen with that. And then, unfortunately, there's the underside of this story, which is private property, because finally these vacant lots are not common lands. They're actually owned by somebody, usually. Either the cities repossess them and are waiting for somebody to develop them into tax-producing revenue streams, or they're privately owned, and the private owners eventually come back and go, wow, thank you for starting this beautiful garden and bringing the neighborhood back from the brink. Now I can sell this, or I can turn it into a, you know, a spot for, this is great. The neighborhood's gentrifying. My land's gone way up in value. Thank you so much. I'll take it back now. And if you haven't, you know, taken the opportunity when it was worth nothing to really get ownership over it and actually end ownership over it, that is to say, put it into the public commons through either a land trust scenario or public ownership or something, well, you lose, and that's what happened to a number of gardens, although by no means all of them in New York City. A recent case in L.A. happened, a 300-acre garden down in L.A. across from a food bank was repossessed by the owner through some shenanigans with city council down there. And now, one of the things I like to emphasize is there's a huge amount of common land in every city that people don't really recognize it as such, because it's covered in asphalt, and it serves one basic purpose, which is to house private automobiles and occasionally move them. And that's an absurd use of public space. Absolutely absurd. It's a really inefficient and poorly thought out use of urban infrastructure and urban space. So at least as a starting point, I think one of our next tasks is essentially to reassert some control over that common space and for other purposes than merely the shuttling around or parking forever of private automobiles. And instead think of that as the starting point for urban food forests and what could we grow if we started shrinking streets to half their size. Maybe not every street, but, you know, many of them could be shrunk a lot. And that new space opened up could be the place where people are growing food and planting fruit trees and free fruit in every city. And I think as we go forward in our society with all the obvious crises ahead of us, with water, fresh water issues, with arable soil issues, with crashing availability of energy, et cetera, and I'm not a catastrophist. I don't think all this stuff's happening overnight, and I don't think it's going to happen, all, you know, in a way that we can't ameliorate it and move forward in interesting ways together. It seems like a pretty good idea to start taking some systematic action towards relocalizing food production as much as we could, including in cities.
That was an interview with Chris Carlson, author of Nowtopia, How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners Are Inventing the Future Today. Find his blog at nowtopians.com. It's really hopeful. And read more in the zine, Processed World. Growing food helped save me. It can help you too. Start small at home. Find a community garden. Find a community right where you live. We're going out with a music mix that's hard to beat. The famed gospel singer Mavis Staples, produced by master musician Ry Cooter. I could listen to almost anything he makes. I'm Alex Smith. Don't tell me you are down and out. Not when you've got that light inside. Let it shine.
shine on me. You can't.